From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. The COVID-19 pandemic has shut down much of North Carolina's business community. A representative of the NC Chamber recently gave state lawmakers an update on the damage. Lawmakers return to Raleigh next week, but many of them have been busy in recent weeks with online meetings. State House Speaker Tim Moore explains why they decided to get a jump on the legislative session. Before the pandemic, the state's higher education leaders already identified a need to adapt to new economic conditions. You'll learn about the group My Future NC. And we'll learn how the COVID-19 pandemic is affecting public school issues such as summer school and student readiness for the next grade. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us, and she has the Carolina Journal headline.
The John Locke Foundation is leading a national effort to highlight a critical flaw in the $2 trillion federal relief package tied to the COVID-19 pandemic. Fixing that flaw could help state governments avoid essentially unsustainable budgets. Amy Cook is the CEO of the John Locke Foundation. She joins us now to talk about why the Locke Foundation is getting involved with talking about this issue. Amy, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Donna, thanks so much for having me again.
So the $2 trillion package, one would presume that at least some of this is going out to the states and local governments who are not going to be seeing the tax revenue they thought they would have, sales tax, income tax, et cetera, but apparently not.
Well, it's the interesting thing about this whole package, and I have to give credit to two people in particular. One is our own Joe Coletti, who found this along with Sarah Curry from the Platt Institute. They really worked together. They brought it to the attention of the Platt Institute CEO, Jim Vogel, and then Joe brought it to me here at the Locke Foundation, and we decided it was too important of an issue that we couldn't just sort of let it go or turn it into, you know, just a column or something like that. It needed to rise to the level of getting other state-based think tanks involved and seeing if they felt the same way we did. And it turns out we had something like 16 other CEOs of other state-based think tanks that signed onto a letter that we presented to Congress. Here's the problem with this, Donna. It's a $2 trillion package, right? Part of that includes a set amount for state. It's $1.25 billion for every state. Plus, then there's a little bit more added on for population. So just depending on what state, depends on, you know, how much money you get. But it's a baseline of $1.25 billion. And these are states and, of course, municipalities, other local governments that have seen, as you said, this absolute plummet in their revenue. And when Joe and Sarah were looking at the language of that $1.25 billion, what the language suggests wasn't really what the spirit of the law was supposed to be. The spirit was the intent of the law was to help states and local governments that we can't print money, right? I mean, we're not most state.
We don't do that here. Some people do, but not in North Carolina.
Don't do that. And so wanted to be able to sort of shore up state and local governments that, took the advice of the CDC, practiced safe social distancing, and essentially shutting down, key industries or shutting down business. I mean, here, North Carolina is an absolute hub, as we know, for, you know, craft breweries and restaurants, and it's really like a foodie's paradise. Well, the food industry and the retail industry got hit hard. That means revenue coming into state and local governments is just plummeting. All of it is crashing. In what this $1.25 billion, the intent was to shore up those governments so they wouldn't have to raise taxes in the future. I mean, that was the idea, the concept behind it.
But it's not happening?
Yeah, well, the language of it was a little bit almost compelling state and local governments to create new spending, which then when I was talking with Joe Coletti and talking with Sarah, of course, at the Platt Institute, what it reminded me of, those of us who remember the 9/11 package, stimulus packages sure. that came out, remember, and where it was just there was a lot of new spending, especially for like first responders and things like that. You know, there were fire stations that got brand new gym equipment, things like that. And I'm not saying that that stuff isn't important, but that may not have been the original intent of that package, or in the case of the 2008, 2009, you know, the Great Recession, where we had the stimulus package in 2009, and then you just saw gobs of money going to sort of pet projects and new spending. I was in Colorado at the time, and we were tracking some of the green initiatives. And it was, you know, they were propping up, new programs were popping up. For instance, there was a state agency there that went from usually having about, you know, $5 to $6 million to spend to having $150 million to spend, and they were just like literally throwing out money. I think, as Joe Coletti put it, literally vomiting money, federal money. So what we did then was we decided to write this letter and just encourage Congress that if they are going to do this, don't, you know, give states some flexibility in how they use it.
And the timing on this, Amy, I think is really important, because we're hearing all sorts of discussion about another package, maybe even another one beyond that package. So the money is going to be flowing. One would think that if this money in the $2 trillion package is set aside, at least some of it, as you said, at least $1.25 billion to each state, plus more, depending on your population, what it sounds like we are setting up for is that they would create these new programs, spend the money, but then still look at their citizens and say, oh my gosh, we got a hole in our budget because we didn't have this tax revenue. And by then it's too late to say, hey, but what did you do with the $1.25 billion that you got from the feds?
Right. And you bring up a great point too about that, Donna, because yeah, there's new spending, right? There's all that there could potentially be a lot of new spending. And then, as you said, they go back to taxpayers. And by the way, our governor here in North Carolina just said, you know, I'm not going to really flip on the economic switch. We're just going to put it on a dimmer. I want to know how long we're going to be in that darkness. So we aren't looking at having a population that would be able to sustain a tax increase. I mean, I can't imagine anything worse for North Carolina's economy than what's going on right now, except we're going to layer on a tax increase to fill the holes of the new spending that has been created, which probably wasn't the intent of this bill. So what we're asking and actually, by the way, the White House asked for feedback. So it was really in the spirit of that. The White House asked for feedback. We were proud to lead the effort to do this, was to watch the language of that and please give states the flexibility. Now, we know there are going to be some bad actors, right? There are going to be some states. Listen, Illinois is, we all know, is where good, you know, budgeting and fiscal responsibility goes to die. North Carolina, on the other hand, is, you know, we're fiscally responsible here. Our state legislature has done a phenomenal job. So give them the flexibility to be able to do that. Don't force them to do to create new spending.
Now, this letter that the John Locke Foundation has helped coordinate with the Platt Institute and signed by the CEOs, not only of the John Locke Foundation and the Platt Institute, but a number of other state think tanks across the country. It has been sent to the leaders of the United States Congress. Amy Cook is the CEO of the John Locke Foundation. Thank you, Amy.
Thanks for having me.
Stay with us. A lot more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are, and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly, but our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Businesses across North Carolina have been rocked by government's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. During a recent online briefing, state lawmakers heard from Ray Starling. He's general counsel for the North Carolina Chamber. Starling presented a list of challenges for businesses. Topping that list, concerns about employee safety.
Every business's top priority is the health and safety of its people, of its employees, and of its customers. Keep in mind that we often think about physical health in a situation like this, but we have employers telling us that they're also having to address mental and emotional well-being among employees. You see that reference there to worker fatigue. That is particularly acute in industries and sectors where folks are being asked to do even more during the pandemic, while at the same time they see their neighbors at home, out on the deck, out on the front porch, or working from home in their blue jeans. So there's a mental piece to this as well. Obviously, our employers are trying to comply with all of the orders that are out there, all the directives that are meant to keep us safe. Essential employees are finding themselves stretched even more thin than normal. One of the challenges we are hearing is access to PPE. If you're going to stay in business and you're going to stay open and you need to take some additional preventative measures, I had an interesting story. At least one employer had 5,000 masks on hand a couple of weeks ago. They donated them to their local health care community. And now, you know, we're all being told it would be best if we all wore masks when we were outside of home. And so they don't now have those for those employees, and trying to procure them at this point is incredibly difficult.
After safety, Starling turned to a sudden jolt in demand for business products and services.
Demand shock, and I'll put some numbers to this. You didn't need me or anybody else to come in and tell you we're in a state of diminished business activity, but a survey that the U.S. Chamber did with MetLife came back in to show that 24% to 25% of businesses have already shut down, small businesses, and among those that have not, so among the 75% that have not, 40% of them believe that they will have to do so if nothing changes. So that gets you to 55% of small business that will have had to shutter as a result of the pandemic. And others, of course, have reduced hours, adjusted employee time. And I think the daunting real question here, you know, when do these losses become unrecoverable? At what point does a small business say, I'm going to shut down and give away the key? The point to be made is that the double whammy, you know, slow the spread restrictions obviously impact demand. A part of that is clearly reduced customer counts, particularly for consumer-facing businesses. But consumer sentiment is also completely disrupted. And at times like these, the individual consumer is really not a lot different than the complex business investor who's missing out on certainty and not sure what to do next. That then impacts confidence, and I think most economists would tell you there's a really strong correlation between consumer confidence and consumer spending. And frankly, we don't have much of either of them. I mean, consumer spending is 70% of our GDP in the United States. So clearly, feeling the pain of not being able to move or sell product.
A third key issue also deals with limited movement during the pandemic.
Supply chain disruption. I think this is talked a lot about, or talked about a lot in the media. It's a major challenge for several of our members, particularly for those who have global or complex supply chains. Or frankly, for businesses who themselves are part of another company's supply chain. We've clearly just seen clear, significant disruption here. Two classes of goods come to mind, those obviously that rely upon Chinese manufacturing, and then those that rely on air cargo transport, as a significant amount of that actually occurs on passenger planes, and with about a third of the passenger planes in the air that we're used to, clearly feeling the pinch there in terms of freight difficulty.
That's Ray Starling, General Counsel of the North Carolina Chamber. He offered an online briefing for state lawmakers addressing the COVID-19 pandemic. Starling turned his attention to smaller companies.
Some of this pain is heightened for small manufacturers because they often have single-source suppliers, whereas larger firms will occasionally spread that demand around. And then, of course, those small buyers are sometimes deprioritized in favor of larger firms that make higher volume purchases for reasons that are readily understood.
Some businesses feel the impact of shifting demand.
In the food world, where up until about a month ago, 50% of the American food dollar was going into restaurants, that is now shifting and being spent, obviously, in grocery stores, or not being spent at all. So obviously, if you're in the food service world, you're having to sort through that in terms of where your product is going to go if it's not going to those restaurants that are open. One interesting one, we've had a lot of chats in the General Assembly through the years about restaurant grease and recycling grease and what the parameters of that are. Imagine if that was one of your inputs. Now most of the restaurants are not producing that product. And so I know that's the case in the animal feed world, and seeing and feeling some of that pinch.
Starling also cited concerns about access to credit and capital and new concerns about lawsuit liability. There's one example linked directly to the pandemic.
We've got a lot of folks in North Carolina that have stepped up to the plate to manufacture PPE when that is not what they have traditionally done. At the end of the day, we may learn that that manufacturing does not produce a product that is perfectly equatable to other PPE manufacturing when that is the core part of a business's function. And so here again, do we need to try to create some protections that take care of these companies that have stuck their neck out there and are willing to step up to the call of duty, if you will, for manufacturing PPE.
North Carolina businesses have concerns about what lies ahead.
This can't last forever. We've got to have some certainty. How do we turn this back on? What are we looking for? The notion that I will know it when I see it really doesn't give me as a business owner the confidence that I need to go back out and put those employees back on the payroll. And I think it's fair to say here, recovery is not a birthright, right? We could do this the wrong way. We are having good conversations with the League of Municipalities and the county commissioners on the fact that we have varying orders across the state that are regulating activity. Really be nice to try to synonymize those in some way. The lack of uniformity sometimes even creates an unfair playing field because one manufacturer may be deemed essential in one part of the state and his competitor in another part may not. So that's been challenging. And then on the regulatory grace part, we've seen a good amount of this already by licensing boards and bodies, and we're grateful for that. But we think that needs to be continued, and certainly anything that has to be dealt with statutorily, we would be asking for your help on.
Starling offered lawmakers a plea about any state-based changes involving unemployment.
This is a system that's financed entirely by contribution that employers make via state and federal payroll taxes. It is not a general fund pot of money, and so we would submit very respectfully that we need to maintain the long-term integrity of that program.
After all the bad news, Starling ended on a high note.
The crisis has also brought to the forefront a number of businesses who are doing, you know, really good things, and so the Chamber is even highlighting on our website, See the Good. There's a lot of generosity, a lot of cordiality, and frankly, even still a good degree of camaraderie alive in the business community. As a state, we do feel that we are better positioned than many That is because of the General Assembly's leadership. The state government itself is in good fiscal health, and we're grateful for that. We also recognize we have a very diverse economy with bright, caring people. So if anybody's going to climb out of this quickly, it's going to be North Carolina.
That's Ray Starling, General Counsel of the North Carolina Chamber. He recently offered state lawmakers an online briefing on the COVID-19 pandemic's impact for businesses. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina lawmakers are looking at steps they can take to help cope with the COVID-19 coronavirus pandemic. House Speaker Tim Moore spelled out a study committee's goals.
Try to come up with consensus solutions to what are a lot of challenges that we've simply never faced before. We know that we're going to have challenges when it comes to health care, education, tax, UI policy, as well as the overall economy. And then, of course, the government functions.
One group is focusing on government, including the future of the General Assembly itself.
What will it look like when we come back in April? Where will we be in terms of meeting? How will we be able to proceed? I can tell you we're looking at several things right now, perhaps allowing voting instead of the normal 15 seconds to vote, allowing 30 minutes or a half hour or full hour, whatever's needed in order to do so. Looking at those kinds of things, looking at, of course, expanding this kind of technology to allow even more committees to meet.
The full General Assembly reconvenes soon.
We know when we come back, we're going to need to be able to hit the ground running. I felt like this would be a lot more, give us a lot more flexibility in terms of us dealing with these issues now so that when we come back at the end of April and beginning of May, that we can move forward with trying to get some consensus legislation passed.
What are some goals of the next legislative session?
It is our intention that whenever we come in, that we also pass a law that extends not only the filing for taxes and waives any penalties, but also waives the interest so that folks can have assurance that if they wait and pay their state income taxes in July, it's not going to cost them anymore. We're seeing a lot of efforts being made to make sure that those who are unemployed get access to their unemployment insurance benefits just as soon as they can. We know there's some issues with getting those processed right now. We're working on ways and communicating actively with the governor to try to find ways to speed that process up as well. We know our small businesses have been impacted greatly. I'm here in Raleigh. You can walk around and see all of the restaurants and things that are normally crowded. Of course, no one's there. All of those folks who are working and getting paid by the hour, who manage to pay their bills every month by what they're getting now, find their worlds turned upside down. We want to make sure they get their help. We know that the federal government has passed a record amount, $2 trillion in stimulus. Of that, roughly $4 billion will be coming to North Carolina. Of that $4 billion, approximately 55% appears to be what will be actually coming to the state. 45% will go to local governments, roughly. We know that all these challenges are there, but we know there are also opportunities. I'm convinced that, as North Carolina always has, that we will get through this.
That's State House Speaker Tim Moore, Republican from Cleveland County. He's discussing the General Assembly's role in helping North Carolina deal with the COVID-19 coronavirus pandemic. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Many of the jobs in our state's growing economy require more than a high school diploma. Yet fewer than half of North Carolinians between the ages of 25 and 44 hold a high-quality post-secondary degree or credential. So what should we do about this mismatch between available jobs and workers' preparation for those jobs? Well, that question helps drive the work of the My Future NC Commission. Joining us now to discuss the group's work are Peter Hans, who is president of the North Carolina Community College System and co-chairman of My Future NC, and Jenny Korn, who is director of strategic initiatives for My Future NC. Thanks for both of you for joining us.
Thank you, Mitch.
So, obviously, this is a big issue, the future of North Carolina's economy, having workers who can fit in these jobs. What is My Future NC trying to do about this?
Mitch, this is a coalition of business, political, and educational leaders who've come together to fix the leaky pipeline in our education system. Right now, we've got a skills gap and an opportunity gap facing the state. A skills gap in the sense that there is a disconnect between the skills that our citizens have and the skills that employers are looking for, often in high-demand fields. There's an opportunity gap in the sense that while there's broad growth and prosperity in the economy, many individuals, many communities are being left out and left behind. If they have the opportunity to increase their educational credentials, they'll be better prepared for the jobs of today, much less tomorrow.
Now, as the person who heads up the statewide community college system, it sounds as if this fits right in the wheelhouse of what community colleges are about.
Indeed, it does. Our 58 colleges serving 700,000 students annually in North Carolina, very focused on a skilled workforce, workforce development, economic development.
This is something North Carolina has been looking at for a while. How does My Future NC fit in with this whole picture?
So My Future NC, I think, is really unique and special because of the commitment from cross-sector leaders. It really, it's been benefiting from people like President Hans and his leadership, President Roper with the UNC system, Mark Johnson, the state superintendent of K-12 public schools. It's really this cross-sector continuum in partnership with some of our best funders and some of the business leaders, CEOs from the medical field, the IT field, banking. Those jobs that are driving growth in North Carolina and making sure that we're thinking about it as an all hands on deck, everybody being at the table. I'm really thinking about the work that the community college system has been leading in the state for so long in partnership with the K-12 community, our local superintendents, our local economic development workforce boards, and really thinking about how we can really drive some of this plan from the state level and also engage down at the local level, really meeting our communities where they are and helping them to move forward in partnership across regions, across county lines together.
That is the voice of Jenny Korn. She is Director of Strategic Initiatives at My Future NC. You're also listening to Peter Hans, who is President of the North Carolina Community College System and co-chairman of My Future NC. I'm guessing a lot of people will hear us and say, yeah, it sounds about right. North Carolina needs to do something different for these jobs of the future. So what are you doing? What's happening at My Future NC right now?
Some of the things that we're going to be working on, and we're working right now on our strategic plan, we're going to be spending the next couple months getting feedback. We're doing that in partnership with our board, but really focused on a couple of key core responsibilities. One about engaging the public in a conversation about the importance of education after high school. There is a real wage difference for North Carolinians that have a high school diploma versus an associate's degree versus a bachelor's or beyond. Tens of thousands of dollars difference by the time you are 10 to 15 years out. So really driving that economic prosperity for our North Carolina citizens and having a conversation about how critical education can be to meet your family's needs. We'll also be doing some additional cross-sector work from the state all the way down to the local level. We're partnering with Carolina Demography. Dr. Becky Tippett is at UNC Chapel Hill, and she has and her team have built a brand new statewide dashboard so that we can measure our progress, not just to the goal, but we have indicators along the way, really helping both at the state level and the local communities see where they have places to grow, where their biggest assets are, whether it's pre-K early enrollment, whether it's K-3 reading or all the high school graduation and then enrollment into our post-secondary systems.
Now, a lot of people have been saying for years and years, more people need to go to college. And we've heard some pushback on that saying, you know, 4-year degree is not necessarily the best thing for everyone. How does My Future NC work on those issues?
That's one of the things I especially appreciate about the My Future North Carolina effort, Mitch, is that it's not just focused on degrees, but education credentials more broadly considered, including industry recognized credentials, certifications in a number of fields that we would offer through the community college system in workforce training. Four-year degrees are great. We're an affordable path, actually, through the community college to a 4-year degree. But there are multiple pathways to success. And I think society actually, to our great detriment, has undervalued other pathways to success, including vocational education, which would be recognized as part of attainment in North Carolina as part of this effort.
If North Carolina doesn't do anything, if we basically just keep the status quo and decide things will work themselves out, what kinds of problems will we have in terms of this mismatch between the jobs that'll be there and people's ability to do those jobs?
Mitch, I think it could be a considerable gap, but really, it's the community colleges that have the scale and the depth and the reach for North Carolina to achieve that goal, because we are so accessible and affordable and flexible, and yet still offer a range of high quality programs that are relevant to each individual circumstance.
Lots of unfilled jobs if we don't do anything about this?
Absolutely. So if we – business as usual, current population projections, enrollment projections say that by 2030, North Carolina will have 1.6 million North Carolinians between the ages of 25 to 44 with some sort of post-secondary degree or credential. Now, that also means that that's an estimate of credentials. Part of the work – and I think President Hans is exactly right – part of the really exciting piece of this work is trying to more effectively define the number of credentials that North Carolinians earn that leads to a family sustaining wage. It's a conversation that other states are having. It'll be a lot of work over the next couple of years to really be able to define that tightly. But I think it really does recognize that it's not just a degree, but really matching the credentials that our employers are looking for with the North Carolina workforce that in order to meet those needs.
Employers are increasingly hiring for skills rather than degrees.
You talked about how at this stage, a lot of this is about community engagement and getting people involved. If people want to learn more about My Future NC, what should they do?
Well, we've got the My Future NC website. It's myfuturenc.org.
Jenny Korn is Director of Strategic Initiatives at My Future NC. Peter Hans is co-chairman of My Future NC and, of course, also the president of the North Carolina Community College System. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Mitch.
Thank you.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, healthcare, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. As you listen to this program, North Carolina school kids may well be sitting near you at a computer engaged in virtual learning. Of course, that's the transition in K-12 education that has been required here in North Carolina due to Governor Roy Cooper's order to close all public schools till at least mid-May as COVID-19 works its way through North Carolina. Here to discuss some of the implications of kids going online and bricks and mortar schools being closed is Dr. Terry Stoops. He is the Vice President for Research, the Director of Education Studies here at the John Locke Foundation. Terry, welcome back.
Thank you.
So this could not be more in your wheelhouse. Not only are you the researcher and analyst, you're a former teacher yourself. You are one of the founders of a public charter school in Wake County. Your wife is a teacher and administrator. So tell us what's going on. Are kids showing up online for school?
Well, some definitely are, but we don't know how many are actually showing up online. And, you know, you have some teachers reporting on social media that almost all of their students are showing up. And you have other teachers reporting on social media that barely any of their students are showing up. And because teachers are not keeping attendance, it'll be impossible for us to know how many students have been showing up for those virtual sessions or completing assignments. another problem that compounds this is the fact that there are no grades necessarily being given. A lot of schools have moved to a pass-fail model. So as long as students are doing the minimal amount of work, they'll probably pass. And so that's another complicating factor in trying to transition from the bricks and mortar education to an online one.
We know that in districts around the state, we are hearing and reading stories that there may be some kids who don't have adequate access to the internet. Other kids may not have the motivation or have parents in the household. Maybe the parents are out working in what's been defined as essential services. Is it that kind of thing that is keeping kids away, or is there just a perception that school really isn't in session?
There is a wide variety of reasons why students aren't showing up. Certainly, the limitations of having an internet accessible device is one, or a broadband connection. I think that's a very important reason why some kids aren't showing up. But you find that there are students that don't feel like this is a real education and that they'll pass anyway, so they don't feel it necessary. You have some parents that are starting to believe that this really isn't a real education either, and that they would rather have their child doing other activities than engaging in online learning with a teacher that is only occasionally in contact with their child. One of the uproars on Twitter recently was a parent saying that she's done having her kid do online education for the year because she doesn't think that it's very valuable for him and that she can come up with activities that are much more valuable for his education. And you start to see some other parents agreeing that the education that their kids are receiving online is not up to par, and so they see it as a waste of time for their child.
Pass-fail seems to me to have all sorts of implications. Number one, how do you really know? Is there an indication that a child has done well or not done well? What about those kids who spent the part of the school year prior to COVID-19 working really hard and trying to get that A, trying to build up, you know, their grades so that they can do well next year, or in the case of older kids, move on to college?
This has been an issue in Wake County, that there are Wake County parents that are upset that grades aren't being given just for that very reason. The kids have been working hard. They've been taking advanced placement courses. They've been trying to get the highest GPA possible to get into competitive colleges and universities. And now it's on a pass-fail system where these kids are on par basically with students that aren't trying as hard. So for the most part, a lot of school districts have resisted the temptation to go back to a conventional grading system and are going to a pass-fail, probably because of the unpredictability of the education that's being offered and the unpredictability of what the students are being asked to do and put forward as work.
Terry, is the school year going to end at the traditional time? What's ahead here?
Well, that's really the question. Governor Cooper closed schools until May 15th, and that means that schools can reopen on May 18th. And that really is the best case scenario. At this point, I think around 21 states have canceled classes for the rest of the school year. I think Governor Cooper was smart to not cancel classes for the rest of the school year and at least give an opportunity for students to come back for a few weeks before the end of the traditional school year. But I think in the end, he will probably cancel classes for the rest of the school year and will be faced with having to deal with the learning loss that came from these previous couple months and from the summer. And that will be the real dilemma going forward, is what do we do for these students who have been ill-served by online education and received no education over the summer?
And to that point, let's kind of work out this scenario a bit. Let's say that the governor chooses to cancel the entire school year. What if there is a county or counties that wants to come back into session, feels they need to? For example, as you and I are talking, there are at least half a dozen North Carolina counties that have zero incidents of confirmed COVID-19 cases. So would local districts have the ability to say, that's nice, Governor Cooper, but we know best here on the ground in our county?
Probably not. I think that the governor's order would probably stand in that case, and probably most school administrators would be reluctant to buck the governor in deciding to come back. So I don't think that would necessarily happen. I think it would certainly be a sound idea, and it should be one that's being discussed with the governor, but the governor would probably have to give some sort of opening for that to happen.
And there might be some real big-time funding questions involved in a decision like that as well, since a big piece of funding comes from the state, at least. So that's going to be fascinating to watch going forward as we hit mid-May and what the governor's decision will be. Terry, I am also seeing on social media some parents saying, well, you know, is the answer to try to catch my kid up, is the answer a longer day, a heavier class load? What do you hear about that?
Well, we don't know. And there's a lot of discussion being put forward about what to do next. Some options include a summer session, but that would require additional funds. There has been a proposal to hold kids back. Low-income, low-performing students should have to repeat the grade next year. I don't think that one is going to go very far. And so I think a lot of people are looking to see what's going to happen in the 2020-2021 school year, whether there will be longer instructional days and other ways for the teachers to be able to catch up and make sure that students are prepared for not only what they missed, but what they were to learn during the next school year.
What does this mean for testing that we traditionally see done each school year and our ability to measure a student's growth, learning growth from year to year?
Well, testing is waived this year, and I think the General Assembly is eventually going to pass legislation that codifies the waivers that were granted by the federal government. But the real question is, what do we do with the 2020-2021 school year? Should we continue testing then? Is it valuable to have test scores after students missed months of school? I don't believe that it is. I think we should waive it for next year as well and just concentrate on getting kids caught up. I think we have to look at using the next school year as a recovery school year.
Terry, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.